Welcome to episode 1 of season 2 of In Focus with David Coletto. I'm David Coletto. Now, former Prime Minister Kim Campbell is notorious for saying that an election is no time to discuss serious issues. Now, that might be true, but it turns out that the best way to win an election campaign may be to run on issues that voters care about and want action on. Donald Trump did it, Boris Johnson did it, and yes, Justin Trudeau did it. That's what I learned from my chat with David Shore, an American data scientist who worked on the 2012 Obama campaign, the 2015 Canadian Liberal Party campaign, and currently is the head of data science at Open Labs, a progressive nonprofit. On the 2012 Obama campaign, Shore worked on the team that developed a polling model that projected Obama's vote share within 1 percentage point in 8 of the 9 battleground states. Prior to working on the Obama campaign, David also worked alongside Nate Silver. A recent New York Magazine article by Eric Levitz that got a lot of attention describes David as a, quote, self-avowed socialist who insists that big-dollar donors pull the Democratic Party left, an adherent of Leninist vanguardism and the medium voter theorem, and someone who can answer any question about U.S. politics by referencing at least 3 peer-reviewed studies. He's recently appeared on MSNBC's Morning Joe and HBO's The Bill Maher Show. So the obvious next booking was In Focus with David Coletto, right? I'm thrilled he agreed to chat. We talked about his thoughts on polling, campaigns, and the simple but important lesson that running election campaigns on issues people care about works. Enjoy my chat. Well, David, thanks so much for agreeing to join the podcast today. You're coming us from New York City. Is that where you are right now?
Yes, that's correct.
And I think I saw on social that you have been vaccinated. So most young Canadians your age are jealous. But that's great news. So congrats on that.
Thank you.
So you have been, you got a lot of attention recently for an interview you did in New York Magazine, where you talked about, why you thought Donald Trump did so well, why it was good for the Republican Party. You have worked on many campaigns. I know for our listeners, one of the first campaigns I think you worked on was up here in Canada in the 2015. Well, not first, but you worked on Obama's 2012, but you also have some experience in Canada. So I'm going to play on that experience and get you to talk a little bit about your experience and your thinking in both countries. But I want to start with a question I've been asking most people I've been interviewing, and that is, you know, you're not a pollster, you're not a public opinion researcher, but you're a data scientist who uses a lot of polling data. But when you're thinking about public opinion and how it drives behavior and how it affects other things in people's lives, do you have an overall philosophy or framework that guides how you think people come to their views and how that affects everything else in their lives?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say that something I really like about, you know, what I do in this like little micro field that we're in is that even though there's a lot of really interesting statistical problems, you know, machine learning and, you know, databases and all of this different stuff, you know, fundamentally everything is about people. You know, we're trying to understand what persuades people? How do you mobilize people to vote? How do you get people to change their minds? What do people really believe and what do people care about? And what I really like is it's really not possible to answer these questions purely from a statistics background. You know, the reality is that politics is deeply tied to history, to sociology. I think that there's value to the data, there is a marriage in this field. And I think that when I look back at, you know, some of the most successful people, I think it's been people who, you know, they have some quantitative skills, but actually the really valuable thing is just having knowledge of the historical context and the political context. Because, you know, it's otherwise political, you know, politics in a lot of ways is arbitrary. Without history, things could be anything.
How do you then take that idea in the models that you do and the work you're doing? How do you bring context and history and those qualitative attributes to the quant work that you're doing? You're a big data guy. So like, yeah. How does big data, you know, deal with those?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And, you know, I think one of the fundamental problems in politics is that, you know, there isn't a large sample size. And like a lot of the most important questions that one might want to answer are kind of impossible, you know, to answer. You can't do a randomized controlled trial where in one universe you run on healthcare, in another universe you run on, you know, whatever. And so something I find really helpful is one, studying history. There have been a lot of different people who have tried to run for office, both here and then in other countries. I think that's the other trick is, you know, recognizing obviously every country is different, but there are constant themes. And so when you look across all of this, all of these different countries, you can kind of build a theory of how things work. You can start to see patterns. And that's really useful because in a world where you can't do experiments all the time, having some theoretical framework or at least multiple theoretical frameworks really helps you hone in on what are the things that are important. You know, and like one example that I talked about in one of my interviews with Eric is just, you know, when you look across when you look across world history, one really clear pattern is that generally speaking, people trust the left, you know, on a lot of economic issues, things like healthcare, things like education, things like lowering income inequality or looking out for the middle class. And people generally trust the right on things like crime, on things like immigration. And this is something that's been, you know, fairly true both across countries and across history. That's just very useful to know. You can then zero in because, you know, otherwise it'd be very hard to answer questions like, what should we talk about? Because you can't, there's all these interesting second order effects. Like, you know, something that we've really seen was like in 2018 when Republicans ran ads saying that they supported pre-existing conditions. On healthcare, I guess in Canada, oh my God, our healthcare debate must seem so crazy to you all. When they did that, it, you know, we found that it actually ended up, you know, increasing support for Democrats, because if you prime people to think about healthcare and you prime the issue space to be on healthcare, then generally the center left will do well. But so that said, you know, one of the big problems about this is that there are a lot of plausible theories about the world. About politics, and you know, all of them are useful, but none of them are right. And so that's where doing experiments is really helpful. So, you know, one example we did a mass testing program in 2020. You know, we tested literally thousands of advertisements when we did randomized controlled trials. Some people saw the ad, some people didn't. You know, we surveyed them after. Looking at the results, I mean, there were some really interesting patterns. You know, 20% of the ads that people made people want to vote for Republicans. So underrated theory of change, find those ads, don't show them to people. I think that generally speaking, one pattern was that, you know, the more people in the office liked the ads, the worse they did. Because, you know, people who work in progressive politics are very different than swing voters. And this is true for voter mobilization too. You know, everybody... the people we want to mobilize are people who don't care very much about politics. And so it turns out that having people who care a lot about politics write ads to try to persuade people who don't care about politics to vote doesn't always work well. There are some exceptions. So that's super interesting. And so it's useful to have these frameworks, you know, when you're coming up with ads, right? Like if you're making an ad, it's not like, you know, it's a very highly dimensional thing. You obviously can't make like a million different ads. Each ad costs thousands or sometimes tens of thousands of dollars to make. So it's very helpful to have these theories about, you know, what direction you want to go in. But then you have to actually test them because none of these theories are perfectly right. Like on one hand, you can say something like, oh, we should make ads about healthcare and we shouldn't make ads about immigration. And that's, you know, it's a good insight, though it's not perfect. But there are other things. Once we tested things, there are other things that end up mattering. Like it turns out, you know, the music that's in the ads ends up mattering, or like sound quality matters, or like, oh, people really like, you know, one thing I think that we noticed was paid actors do worse than real people. You know, there's like lots of little things like that that don't. And so, I don't know, it's very helpful to know about history and have like these different models because otherwise the decision space is too large. But then the value of data and testing is that then you can actually test these results. And I think that's something that's very helpful.
So you just dumped a whole bunch of stuff that we could spend another hour talking about, but you said something that is, I'm taking us in a totally different direction now, because you said something in that last comment about oftentimes people who are in politics think what's good is different than the people they're trying to reach, right? You mentioned progressives, but here in Canada, for example, the Conservative Party is having a really, I think, hard time connecting with voters, in part because their base, their elites, dislike Prime Minister Trudeau far more than even those that would be open to voting Conservative do, right? And so their anger and their frustration and their deep dislike for him gets kind of, it oozes out in their social kind of feeds and the way that they talk about politics. But for someone who's not a hardcore Conservative in Canada, that doesn't really connect, right? So I think that's really interesting, and that the data really picks up that our guts, even people like you and I who look at this stuff every day, think about politics probably way, way too much.
Right.
Don't probably have a good sense of what works or not unless we're testing this stuff.
Yeah, I think that's the core problem in politics, which is that the people who work in politics on either party are really fundamentally very different. You know, there's some trait of how interested you are in politics, how liberal or conservative you are. And the people who literally staff campaigns are all the way at the end extreme. You know, one statistic I like to give is that white people with a college degree who are under the age of 34, they're about 4.5% of the electorate, but they are close to a literal majority of people who work in Democratic politics. And so I don't think it's a surprise that, you know, whatever we say ends up coming out sounding really weird. And, you know, I don't think that there's representation is important. Everything we could do to be more diverse is good. But realistically, you know, all institutions are run by highly educated people. And like the selection pressure is very high. I think, you know, we should be mindful and try to counterbalance it. But I think the only real solution here is measurement. You know, I think the core problem in politics, as I said before, is this difference combined with the idea that where people are really ideologically motivated, you know, to do dumb things. You know, something I said, I like to say is that, you know, I don't see my job as doing smart things. You know, I mean, to be clear, the data science and all of it, it's all really cool. Like, but most of the value in what, you know, I think pollsters do is to prevent people from doing really dumb things. you know, because people can, you know, because people who work in politics care a lot about what they're doing. I think it's a beautiful thing. And I don't want to, you know, come off as criticizing it. I think all of these people mostly could make a lot more money doing something else. And they have these deep convictions. But those convictions can cloud our thinking and can really convince you to believe something that you want to be true that isn't true. In our value is to like kind of step back and say, that's kind of crazy. Like, the stories you hear a lot are like, oh, sure, most of the public opposes this policy, but if we run on it, it'll mobilize our base, you know? And there's like lots of magical thinking like that. And it's very important to actually like do the algebra and see if this stuff pencils out. That doesn't mean you're always going to be right. I think there's a lot of cases of, you know, the numbers people making important mistakes that end up mattering. But I think that's the core challenge is like, how do we step outside of our privilege and our background and understand what people actually want?
One of the, and just building then on that idea, one of the things that I've been particularly interested in reading about what happened in the UK around Brexit and the recent UK election there, where you saw these like historically red Labour seats in Northern England flipping to the Conservatives. I think you saw it obviously in the United States with sort of the Midwest and the Great Lakes states sort of going to Trump in 2016 and then close in 2020. And in the New York Magazine article you quoted was saying, highly educated people tend to have more ideological, coherent and extreme views than working class ones. Unpack that for me and what the implication of that means for progressive parties trying to keep that, what has traditionally been a pretty core part of the coalition, but also what it means for, you know, the rise of, I think, authoritarian populist right leaders that we've seen, not just in the US and the UK. Doug Ford, the Premier of Ontario, I think effectively used the same kind of tactics. Like, explain that what that means, I think, for our politics today.
Yeah, I mean, education polarization, we've spent the whole time talking about it. But I'll talk a little bit about ideological coherence, you know, because when I say, educated people hold more ideologically coherent views, yeah, I want to be clear, you know, that's almost in some ways a tautological statement. Like when we define what does it mean to be ideologically coherent, you know, we say, you know, there's highly educated conservatives who believe that immigration, there should be less immigration and that, you know, taxes should be lower. And then you have, you know, educated liberals who are the opposite. Like what ideological coherence is kind of tautologically defined, you know, is what educated people believe. But the important thing to remember is that most voters aren't like that. You know, there's this great paper by David Brockman, and it was written about a lot, if anyone just Googles moderates aren't moderate, David Brockman, where he really studied, you know, he asked a battery of issue questions on like a 1 to 7 scale for like unions and taxes and all these different things. And, you know, what he found about moderates is that, you know, moderates aren't like David Brooks, you know, they aren't like these socially liberal, economically conservative people who just want everything to be in the middle. Moderates are mostly working class people. Actually, like, you know, generally education is highly correlated with having extreme ideologies, being liberal or very liberal or very conservative. And most moderates are less educated. And they tend to have on issues, have extreme views, but in just totally different directions. So there are lots of people who are like, I think we should have a national healthcare system. And also, I want to deport all the undocumented immigrants. And that kind of thing is very common. And something I think was really cool is, you know, a lot of people then say, oh, well, these people are just answering things randomly. But then they went and they did these experiments and, you know, they actually showed that, you know, basically where they have these hypothetical candidate matchups and who believe different things. And what they found is, you know, these random beliefs in every direction that people hold are really quite mm-hmm. sincere. And so I think the key to Donald Trump's success, I think a lot of people, because educated people dislike Donald Trump so much because of the way he talks and what he says, I think they don't, you know, understand that, you know, Donald Trump really got so far because of issues. His power was that because he wasn't beholden to either ideology, he said, I think that we shouldn't cut Medicare, we shouldn't cut Social Security. And he also said, I want there to be fewer immigrants. And, you know, it turns out, that is a very popular combination of beliefs. It's just a very popular combination of beliefs that educated people on both sides don't hold. And that's why Donald Trump was actually rated, you know, in the ANES, if you look at the feelings thermometers, as I think probably the most moderate person to run for president in decades. And his base, you know, in the Republican primary wasn't conservative activists. It was actually moderates in the Northeast, you know, and former Democrats, which is something, you know, I think people don't acknowledge. And so, you know, that's the danger of ideological coherence is that as the center left, you know, brings in these educated voters, it can become a little bit of a straitjacket. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the big problems that the Republicans have had for a long time is that they've always insisted on running on these very unpopular entitlement cuts and tax cuts. Like if you look at Mitt Romney, for example, you know, the mm-hmm. RNC was just like an insane ode to small businessmen and rich people. And, you know, the reason that happened was because the people who worked in Republican politics very earnestly believed this. And, you know, the danger is that now we're gonna face the reverse. Like now Donald Trump, you know, he actually successfully, because his base is less ideologically coherent, he was able to get away with, you know, I'm just gonna talk about the good things and I'm not gonna mention the unpopular things. I'm not gonna run on making it easier to pollute rivers or cutting taxes on the rich. I'm going to talk about crime. I'm going to talk about immigration. I'm going to talk about jobs. And, you know, the danger is that as the left becomes more educated, that we'll start facing the same kind of constraints.
I mean, just proof of that was this week with Mitch McConnell bashing big business, right? Like you wouldn't,
right.
Mitch McConnell of the 1990s or early 2000s was a creation of that world, and now he's been able to completely adopt Trump's version of it and keep a connection with those voters. It's fascinating. I mean, so your point about there not being quote moderate voters, do you think there are such things as swing voters then? We use that term so much. Does a swing voter exist, or is it simply back to an earlier point you made, a voter that has, you know, different views, maybe what ideologically pure people would say are contradictory views that are activated by issue salience at different times. So they're just simply swinging based on what issue is more important to them at any given moment. And it could be, I'm going to vote liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican, but it's all about what issue matters to me today.
I think that's exactly my model of the world. You said it very well. Is that since you have these people who have these wildly disparate views, every time you open your mouth, you're going to win some people and you're going to lose other people. And then what you say becomes like a real optimization problem. And, you know, I think that that is the knowing that and knowing the terrain is why the salience is so important. You know, center left, if we make the discussion be around healthcare, then as long as we take popular views on healthcare, then things will be good for us. And if we make the discussion about immigration, and this is a different thing than what you do, but just realizing that the scorecard is that we need to try to get the media to talk about this and not about that is very useful. And just to put some evidence here, you know, like I really like to say something that I think a lot of educated people missed about 2016 is that it was about issues. You know, I have a graph that I tweeted out about a year ago, where if you look, we did in a post-election survey, we asked people attitudes on immigration and attitudes on universal healthcare. And if you look at people who agreed with us on universal healthcare and disagreed with us on immigration, it's about 12, 13% of the electorate. And it's obviously disproportionately, you know, working class white voters, particularly in the Midwest. Obama got about something like 62 or 63% of them, and Hillary Clinton got 39%. And, you know, that's just the story. That's what happened. You know, so I think that was the mistake of 2016, was that there were these there was this large block of electorally important people whose votes are just worth more due to our terrible undemocratic election system. And we decided to take, I mean, to be clear, Donald Trump very wisely was like, I'm gonna increase the salience of immigration. But then Democrats doubled down. You know, we just thought, this is clearly a weakness. And we decided to raise the salience of immigration in an election where the swing voters were, you know, voters who disagreed with us on immigration and agreed with us on healthcare. And I think that was a massive mistake that, you know, we had a very narrow loss. I think if we had made different messaging choices, we would have probably won.
And I think that lesson, I saw you commenting on it as well, I think carries over to non-white voters, right? This assumption that African-American, Black voters, Latino Democrats can count on them. They're going to vote for us because on the immigration issue, on the other side, that you know, Trump's repelling them. And I think you did your deep dive on 2020 and said, well, actually, there were pretty significant swings in favor of Trump, right? Among those voters. What's the lesson there then? Is it the same lesson, just applied slightly differently to a different group of voters? Or what's happening with non-white voters in the US that, again, I think there's lessons for us up in Canada to know about?
Yeah, I think the key thing, which I think is counterintuitive and very surprising, is that, you know, and I'm sure this is true in Canada as well, is that even though partisanship varies a lot by race, you know, in the US, ideology, and I just mean if you ask people, do you identify as a liberal or moderate or conservative, does not vary by race. Roughly the same proportions of white, Black, and Hispanic voters identify as liberal, moderate, or conservative. And so these two facts existing at the same time, it can only be true because Democrats historically do very well with non-white conservatives. And among white people, the electorate is very polarized on ideological lines. You know, Democrats get about 90% of white liberals and about, you know, and Republicans get about 80% of white conservatives. But among non-white voters, traditionally, I think, you know, I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think Barack Obama won Hispanic conservatives by something like 30 points. And then you flash forward to 2020, Donald Trump won Hispanic conservatives, I believe by about 20 points. And so basically the entirety of the decline among Hispanic voters, or a very large fraction of it, just comes from this massive shift and realignment among Hispanic conservatives. And I think there's, you know, similar stories, you know, for African-Americans and Asians as well. And so I think, you know, it's hard to know exactly why anything happens in this world. Causal inference is hard. This kind of gets to why I think history is important. Can't do RCTs on everything. But you know, if I think that as the party has gotten more educated and more liberal, I think that the highly educated people have started to redefine, you know, the center left in their own image. And, you know, the important thing to remember is most voters are not liberal. Most swing voters are not liberal. Most get out the vote targets are not liberal. And more than that, most non-white voters aren't liberal. And so if you, to be clear, all of these groups support a variety of center-left priorities. There are a lot of broadly popular center-left priorities that are popular across ideological lines. But then there are also issues that are very polarizing. And you know, the general pattern is there are broadly popular economic issues, though socialism is not one of them. And then there are kind of divisive social issues. Though to be clear, there are also broadly popular social issues. You know, one example is police reform. Defunding the police is very unpopular, even with non-white voters. But police reform is actually one of the most popular things we've pulled in the wake of George Floyd. And so I think, you know, the secret, given that most voters are not liberals, and I don't know what the Canadian word for liberals are, and I know that it's...
We use progressive, because there's the Liberal Party, which confuses things, right?
Yeah. Right, and then liberal means something totally else, and you say something totally different.
An identity, it's a partisanship as opposed to an ideology.
Yeah. Right, but for progressive, most voters are not progressive. Something I like to, just a soundbite I really love to give, is that everyone likes to say in our space, I've just heard it so often, that, you know, the problem with the left, you know, the center left, we're eggheads. You know, we talk too much about issues, we're too wonky, we need to communicate our values. And that's just totally wrong. You know, the swing voters don't share our values. If they did, they would be liberals, they'd be progressives, and they're not. Our values are weird and alien to them. You know, they don't agree with us in terms of like what an ideal society should look like, you know, the roles of race and gender, and all of this other stuff. Cause we're, I don't know, progressive people are pretty different. You know, if you look at racial resentment questions, if you look at personality, generally we're much more open to new experiences. There's a lot of differences. And some of those I hope can be bridged with time, but most of them won't. And that means that if we want to appeal to the population and win elections, we have to talk to people in terms that they understand about issues that they care about. And I used to take a negative view on this. I used to say, oh man, you know, the voters, they're so dumb, whatever. But now I think I really assign a lot of value. I think that, I mean, I'm not going to take the extreme view on this, but I think there's something fundamentally good about political parties trying to appeal to the median voter and focus on the issues that people care about. I think it's become a little bit of a dirty word, and I think we've gone too far in that direction.
So just to be clear then, Donald Trump is able to become the nominee of the Republican Party in 2016 because he brought those new voters into the party, not because Republican elites sort of said, we want to win and he's the best choice for us to win.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And if we look through Donald Trump's base was former Democrats, it was moderates. It wasn't what the conservative elites wanted. They wanted Ted Cruz. And I think Donald Trump, it just shows the power of running on popular ideas is, you know, Donald Trump, one of the most hated men in America, hated by everyone in the Republican Party establishment. But he went through and he just said on every single thing, I'm going to say the popular thing. And it worked. And I think that there's other examples that work too. You know, that was Joe Biden's approach to politics in the Democratic primary. And he won despite really having very little institutional support. And I think if you look at Pete Buttigieg, he didn't win. But he had a similar strategy of talk to the media as much as you can, try to position yourself where the people are, which involved coming out against Medicare for All. And it nearly worked for him. He won. He probably won Iowa, maybe. And so it just shows these are really powerful tools. And I say that because in my space, you know, working in politics, you know, there's a lot of stuff that isn't ideologically threatening that, you know, we go and we sell. Like I build micro-targeting models and we choose, you know, what color our website should be or whatever. And like those things all have statistically significant effects. But like they don't matter that much. Ultimately, what matters is running on popular things, appearing moderate, appearing reasonable. That's just so much more powerful than everything else. It's really like it's something that can make like a small town mayor almost be president. Like that's the power of doing it. And so you'd think people would do it more. But they don't. There's a lot of, you know.
Well, I think one of the reasons is you often hear is, you know, we shouldn't, maybe it's not governed by polls, but we shouldn't run just on what the polls say people want. Right. I think that's very much an elitist comment. Like we got to lead, and leadership is about pulling people where they should go, not where they are. I guess.
Yeah.
And there's, I think that's a fair argument, except if you are up against somebody who's running on what people want, odds are that person will win.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to not disregard the public. Sometimes you'll be lucky and, you know, you have an ideological cartel and they'll both do unpopular things. I'm not going to be an extremist. The public isn't right about everything. But you know what I'll say is that I think in practice, when people say we shouldn't govern by public opinion, you know, at least in the context of the left, what they really end up saying is that we should care, like we should privilege the concerns of highly educated people over working class people. And, you know, just to talk about some research that, you know, I did recently, if you go and you ask people, you know, to rank order their priorities, you know, liberals and particularly white liberals care a lot about climate change. And, you know, I care about climate change. But, you know, working class people and actually, you know, working class non-white Democrats care a lot more about things like unemployment. And I don't think it's obviously progressive. I think in a lot of ways, it's actually like very corrosive to have a situation where we say, you know, this insular group of highly educated, you know, white liberals who dominate our party, we're going to care about their priorities at the expense of, you know, the material well-being of working class people. I think that, you know, I understand the argument in the other direction, you know, climate change hurts poor people in Bangladesh, and et cetera. But I think, you know, there needs to be a balance, and I'm worried that we've gone too far in one direction. Right.
On the other hand, if you are a white liberal running a campaign or working inside the prime minister's office or the Oval Office, and you want to win an election and you want climate action, you better not run on climate change. You should run on unemployment. And then, you know, because if your goal is simply to win in order to do the agenda that you want, right?
And you know what I would say, you know, I think it's funny. I'm not going to claim that you should always try to win as opposed to standing up for what's right. But I think that people have a lot of cognitive biases that push them in favor of overestimating. You know, it makes them think that it's always the right thing to do, to stand up for what you believe in. And I think that winning is actually very important. You know, keeping in the context of the US, you know, the other side, I mean, I don't know how partisan this podcast is, but like, I think Donald Trump controlling the government is legitimately a very scary thing. You know, I think US democracy is legitimately at threat. And I think liberals say this all the time. I think they believe this, but I think if you take that seriously, if you really say, wow, the US has an existential risk, and I think this is true for other countries too, where there is a real existential risk for the stability of liberal democracy, isn't that worth moderating a little bit on social issues to try to prevent that? Like if you really believe that this is what's at stake. I don't know. I think winning is, yeah. I think winning is very important. I think that listening to the public, it's normatively good, but it's also just like good advice.
I don't do partisan polling in Canada for parties, but I worked on a mayoral campaign in a small city in Nova Scotia, Cape Breton, regional municipality.
Yeah.
And we did some polling for a candidate, a challenger who was 30 points behind when we did the benchmark poll. And we asked voters, what's the most important issue? What do you want the candidates to focus on in this race? And then we put it in a word cloud forum, right? A very simple thing. And roads was the largest word. And so he said that was not in his agenda. He was a passionate guy, a social entrepreneur, wanted to do good. And he said, you know what? Okay, I'm going to run on roads in order to win so that I can do a lot of the other things I think the community needs. And he almost won. It was like 2 points. He closed the gap, but he said, I would have not run on roads if I didn't ask people, what do you want me to run on? What matters to you? Right. So it was one of those moments where I think the candidate saw the research and it changed his mind, but also realized that if I run on what I care about, I'm not likely going to win because I'm not normal. I'm running for office.
I think, and to be clear, I think that's a good story. I don't think there's anything nefarious there. Obviously maybe kind of, you know, the other things he cares about are more important than roads. I don't know. But I want to tell a related story, which is, you know, when we've actually done experiments and testing, you know, something that really comes through is that, you know, clean water lead cleanup, it's a really big deal. It's not something educated people care that much about. It's not very salient for us, but like actually a lot of working class people live in areas where the municipal water, like, you know, just to go into a little bit of history, like in the Midwest, you know, a lot of, you know, they had a bunch of, they kind of built their sewer systems early. They had a bunch of left-wing local governments that were elected in the beginning of the 20th century. And, you know, one of the problems with building your sewer system 30 years before everyone else is you end up with lead pipes, which is bad. And so the EPA is like, hey, you have to fix these lead pipes. And, you know, these cities have declining populations and a declining tax base. It's a real problem. And also people don't want their kids to drink lead water. You know, rich people are insulated from this. They live in excellent neighborhoods and excellent homes. And so it's just not something we talk about. But when you do the opinion research, clean water really spirals almost to the top. And I think that, you know, now I think because of this research, I think that there's a lot of people in the Senate who are trying to prioritize clean water. And I think that's good. I think stepping outside of your bubble is like a good thing. I'm being repetitive here, but I just wanted to share that.
No, I think that's your, you know, that's the lessons and the not even a theory. I think there's so much good lessons from your takes here on this. I really appreciate you taking the time. It was nice to meet you, and keep up the really amazing work. If you, for our listeners, you know, follow David Shore on Twitter. He's always sharing, like, I'll admit, nerdy graphics, but I love them. If you love data, he's got great stories to tell. So David, thanks so much for joining.
Thank you. Real honor. Take care.